Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, and it's a mean day today because it's Michael Hawley Day. How you doing, Mike?
Great, great. It's snowing outside my window here in Buffalo, New York.
Well, it does that all year, doesn't it? July.
Feels like it. That's right.
Yeah, you know, two months of summer.
Yeah, chicken wings and snow. That's what we have here.
Yeah, why do they call them buffalo wings? You know.
You know, that's what happens when they're from Buffalo.
Yeah, because you got lots of buffalo there, don't you?
No bison here. That's one of the misconceptions.
Oh, come on. I mean, you know, anyway. Well, I'm not going to go there. I was going to get into trouble, but I'm not going to get into trouble today. Well, we've got a great guest, and he's working on doing a documentary. So let's get him in and talk about this. So Dacre Stoker, thank you for coming on the show.
Absolutely, Al. Thank you. And Michael, thanks for being here with us as we can chat all about, you know, my great-granduncle Bram Stoker and how I'm trying to shuffle the deck and show people something a little bit different about him than they've ever seen before.
What exactly you're trying to put together here? You're trying to put together a documentary, and you've got some great people to work with here. So maybe explain kind of what you hope to achieve with this documentary.
So, you know, the point is I've been working on better understanding my great-granduncle Bram Stoker for about 15 years now. I found all kinds of interesting documents that he wrote, letters, a journal, his Dracula typescript, the manuscript, Dracula notes, things that other people said about him, newspaper articles, and I kind of pulled them all together. And I've used those to write two international bestsellers, a prequel to Dracula called Dracul and a sequel, Dracula the Undead, and it published his journal. And I've also got involved with a buddy of mine, Chris McCauley from Edmonton, an Irishman living in Edmonton. The way far north, Michael. and we've done a range of games and audio stories, video games, board games, RPG games. But the last frontier, as far as I'm concerned, is film. And I had hoped, you know, putting in a lot of feelers, shooting a lot of pitches at different studios over the years, that somebody would pick up on some of the ideas I had about a Bram Stoker documentary. And we got close a few times. There was some interest raised, but, you know, you get to the final piece of it all and, you know, oh, no, we just can't raise the money, or, oh, no, not at this time. So these two fellows that I met in when I was in Dublin, Ireland, at a film festival, Jason Figgis and John West, you know, we've been there so close, and we had great outlines, great ideas, and we just said, you know what, if this is going to happen, let's just do it ourselves, and if we have to raise a little money to do things like editing and so on, we'll crowdfund, and that's really where we are at. Al is I've been able to on travels to Transylvania, Scotland, where Bram wrote the novel, Whitby, where he was inspired and wrote some of his notes, two places in Ireland, to have a couple of friends come along who have shot really good footage, drone footage, GoPro footage as we're walking into castles, stuff like that. So we didn't have to pay for a film crew to go do that. We've collected great footage. I mean, the cameras nowadays that you can that a normal guy could use. Pretty darn good if you know what you're doing. And Jason Figgis has all that. We've actually done the script already. I've narrated, if you can believe it, you know, on my iPhone and sent it across to Ireland.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's incredible what is available if you just have a good microphone and so on. So we've got the concept down, we've got the basic idea, and it just needs to all be edited with all the right still photos. And we've got friends of mine, the Talking Heads, who are experts in the field in certain areas. And it's going to come together, but once we get the thing edited with some money from Indiegogo, which starts in April. So the concept is to do something that no one's done before, is really to show a side of Bram Stoker in a documentary. I mean, he appears in documentaries about Dracula or about vampires. Stoker the Irishman who wrote this. But nobody really goes into depth into the events in his own life that were woven into the story, the actual research that he did, where did he get very specific things that show up in the novel. So that's what we're aiming for, along with my two creative buddies, Jason Figgis and John West.
So, Dacre, Jason Figgis and John West I've been working with for about a couple years, and both are just amazing. I think if anyone can do this with the Indiegogo, they can do it. So I've been just impressed with the stuff they've done already, so I'm excited about this.
So just, jump in for a second, and Michael, tell me briefly what's your project, because I know there's some overlap. We had actually, Figgis had told me stuff he's working on. But I didn't know you were actually involved in this. So
yes.
There's a crossover. It's Victorian horror kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, absolutely. What happened was Jason is friends with a mutual friend, Stuart Evans. And so what happened is I just finished my latest book on Francis Tumbley. And the person that actually did the foreword is Neil Story. And by the way, he sends his best. Neil sends his best.
Yeah, he did a great visual biography of Bram. Yeah.
Yes.
What a small world. That's great.
I know. A small world. And so I've been finding, it's amazing. Here's a Jack the Ripper suspect. And the question I always got was, well, if he truly was a serial killer, when Tumbley sneaked back to America, were there any murders, Ripper-like murders on South? Honest to God, I found 39 where I can't eliminate him.
Yeah.
And then 37 assaults that match him. So Jason wants to put that to film. And so we are trying to do this as well. But I think we're kind of like, I'm a little one step behind you. So it won't be anything ready. I'm actually hoping that you could get yours done. You were talking about maybe the Halloween time frame. That would be awesome.
Yeah. Well, let me ask this for a moment, and Alan, you can weigh in here on what you may know about it. The connection between Francis Tumbleton and Hall Caine, a great friend of Bram.
Oh, yes.
Bram dedicated Dracula to. I think there's definitely a crossover here, Michael, besides us knowing each other and us and Figgis. So this is part of Bram's life. I mean, he had mentors in his life. He had people that saved his butt when he lost a lot of money on not very good, let's say, investments. Hall Caine, very famous writer at this time, made a lot of money, and he came to help Bram from time to time. I've seen very interesting letters between the two
that
talk about their quest to stop copyright infringements, plagiarism. Mm-hmm. That's interesting in itself when you think of copyright and Prana Films and Nosferatu, but we won't go there.
Yeah.
And also, Hall Caine wrote one of the most incredible eulogy to Bram Stoker, a very in-depth eulogy.
Yes, right.
And so, what do you know about the connection between those three guys?
Well, what happened is it was the mid-1970s when Francis Tumbley finally started an office in Liverpool, and that's how he met Hall Caine first. Then... Neil Story had found some of these letters, and there was a photograph in there of both Hall Caine and Francis Tumbley. Now, if you go to Wikipedia, the photograph of Tumbley in the Prussian helmet is not him. It's the one that Neil Story found. That's the actual photograph.
Yeah.
But what happened was, Francis Tumbley himself said that he
would visit the Beefsteak Club at the Lyceum Theater, and of course, Bram Stoker was
That's
there.
That's his domain. Yeah.
Yes, his domain. And then what had happened was is the Order of the Golden Dawn that was started there. You know, one of their goals was to get the Philosopher's Stone or the Elixir of Life, and that's what Tumblety's goal was. He even talked about this elixir, and there was actually a theory that a prominent engineer from the wealthy West End went to Scotland Yard and said that it's a Jekyll Hyde type person they think Jack the Ripper was. During the day, he's a prominent physician. At night, he's a medical maniac looking for the elixir of life, mixing herbs with the fluids of the uterus. And Tumblety was an herb doctor. And so these connections with this elixir of life, and then the Lyceum Theater, and then of course Tumblety had a passion for theater, and then there's always these close connections with that, and that right that there. So, and then here's Tumblety was he was so enamored with youth and this elixir, and what even though I wrote in my book The Ripper's Haunts about that, I just found Baltimore attorney was saying that it was under sworn testimony in around 1901, he's carrying around this flask of this brown stuff and he's drinking it. Oh, like boy. A concoction, like an elixir. It just keeps on coming. So, yeah.
Well, listen, for all the listeners, what you're hearing are two guys who are so caught up in this, you know, the interesting intrigue of the Victorian era, and Bram Stoker was kind of an observer. And I'll just say this, because this is where we get back to our film for a moment, is the context of Bram Stoker's life. He moved from Ireland to work in the Lyceum Theater. And when he came over here in 1878, things changed dramatically. He was in the middle of the intelligentsia, in the middle of the creative world. He had survived a 7-year childhood illness where he was an invalid. He was able to become a champion athlete after doing lots of long distance walking to get his health back. And he became a champion long distance walker through Trinity College, as well as all-around athletics, rugby, rowing, all that stuff. But he also had to become a civil servant because the family needed some money as his dad retired. So imagine the creative guy that we're talking about being kind of shoved into this role that he had to do for the good of the family and put aside his own desires to get into writing, to get into art, and to get into theater. And the way he survived is he did pro bono theatrical reviews. But he also was promoted to become the inspector of clerks all over Ireland. And this is where it gets interesting, guys, because before he came to London, he was traveling around Ireland to the 30-some-odd counties by carriage and by train to go visit the different clerks and make sure they're all doing the right legal job. Doesn't that sound just a little bit like Jonathan Harker traveling all the way across Europe by train and then carriage to go and consummate the legal transactions that Count Dracula's doing? So even though this was not something Bram really wanted to do, he used that kind of stuff. His personal experiences when he was in sort of hostile ground to go check up on all these other clerks. And funnily enough, he found that they were doing such a terrible job, there was no continuity in handing out penalties and the law, that he came back and told his boss, we've got to write a manual. And he says, well, go ahead, Bram Stoker, you write the manual. He wrote a legal manual called The Duties of Clerks of Petty Sessions that was in use until the 60s in Ireland. That's the type of Jonathan Harker guy he was. But to get back to where Michael and I are coming from, the Victorian era was full of very interesting, let's just call it occult times. To put it in perspective, The Origin of the Species was just written, and it was published in 1859, I believe. And Darwin had made a lot of outlandish claims, which was in conflict with, obviously, religion. So the power of religion was beginning to wane a little bit, the power over the people. And as the scientific world was beginning to pop up and go, wait a sec, we need some scientific proof to prove these things that you're all thinking would happen. And then people start thinking really about spiritualism. and as we call today, paranormal investigation, mesmerism, tarot card readings, seance, all that stuff is moving around. And you mentioned the Order of the Golden Dawn. Bram was a Freemason. I don't have any proof that he was a Dawner, but he was, you know, in that world was very interesting to him. And I have found books and I found letters that he's written to sort of known occultists, people who were advanced thinkers that had to practice their trade or their, you know, their interests, or talk with other guys about this behind closed doors so they would not be subjected, you know, to ridicule, especially a guy who is an upstanding theater manager. So just putting all this out here, Alan, to sort of to tell your listeners, this is the landscape that Bram Stoker was working in. The time was right to create a supernatural being. The time was right to be thinking about trances and Lucy's trance walk through Whitby, to have the brain control of Count Dracula on Mina when there was a blood exchange. The time was right to have science questioning, was Count Dracula an evil scientist who was forcing Renfield to eat different forms of life to experiment? The time was right that mental patients, people with mental health problems, were usually shoved into prisons, but now they're put into asylums for hopefully better care. So there's a lot of kind of interesting social statements that Bram Stoker is making, as well as capitalizing on these sort of fears and worries of people who are ready to read a book that, you know, Bram Stoker made seem real.
And you you say that the one and only interview has been discovered with Bram talking about his writing of Dracula. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I didn't discover it. I'm not sure who did, but it's been floating around. But it was by Jane Stoddard in the British Weekly. And it was published just about 3 months after Dracula was published in May 26, 1897. What's interesting, Alan, is we've seen other reviews of Dracula, but not interviews, which I am intrigued about. So this one is the only place where someone actually says, "And Mr. Stoker, where did you get this idea? Or where did you come up with the vampire myth?" And what we see is Bram Stoker admitting that the myth is something that's been going on for a while. It is very prevalent in many countries. He listed off 12 countries where he had found treaties on, and we won't just say vampirism because it's, you know, any kind of revenant creature, souls of the undead coming out, malicious souls, they sort of call them. So he goes into detail in what he found in different places, and that he's been interested in it for an awful long time, which makes me believe he may have picked up some of this stuff when he was a younger man living in Ireland. And I'll say this, that I've discovered in one of the books in his own library that his great-grandsons have, because I've been privy to my cousin's holdings, some of the books that they still have. One of them was written by Oscar Wilde's mother, Lady Jane Wilde.
Oh, interesting.
And wow. In it, she writes all about Irish superstition and folklore. And she actually wrote something close to these words, that Irish superstition is very similar to that of Transylvania, where they have their versions of the vampires and the banshees and so on. And that these are very similar. They treat the dead in a similar fashion, these mourning rituals where you have to do all kinds of things to make sure that the souls rest in peace. So that could have been something that triggered Bram as a younger man. And it also drew the connection to Madame Gerard, who is a Scottish lady who wrote a book called Land Beyond the Forest. And in it, she had a essay on Transylvanian superstitions that's referred to in this interview. So both the interview refers to Emily Gerard and this book by Lady Jane Wilde. And then, of course, the London Library made this discovery a couple of years ago, and I helped verify all this, had all 26 of the books that Bram listed in the back of his Dracula notes. Almost like he's doing a doctoral thesis. He lists his sources. Now, it's a book of fiction. You don't have to do that, but he did it. He's that kind of persnippity guy. Huh. And in it, we can now read Transylvanian Superstitions by Emily Gerard, who goes into absolute detail how to kill a vampire, cut the head off, put garlic in, stake it in a heart with a stake, all the things Bram used. So that interview, Alan, was sort of the, you know, the starting point that started me going towards the books he wrote that were mentioned, Emily Gerard, London Library. It's like little pieces of a puzzle that all, you know, fit together. And once you, you might get three or four together, and boy, when you find that fifth one, in this case, the Lady Jane Wilde book, it like made everything make sense.
And, you know, in popular culture, you know, Vlad the Impaler, what was his connection with Vlad?
So again, there was a book in the Whitby Library and in the London Library, one by William Wilkinson and one by James Samuelson. And it mentions Vlad the Impaler being known as the devil. And that, I believe, was the connection. So you go back a little bit to what I said earlier about the occult. There were devil worshippers, you know, some of them very fringe, but there was devil worshipping going on. But there was also just the interest in the other world. What's going on? You're good, you go to heaven, you're bad, you go to hell, and in between, you're in purgatory, that sort of thing. But Bram was interested in how people felt about the devil. What was the devil incarnate? What is he like? What would he be like if he came back as a human being? And he finds somebody with a realistic backstory in Vlad the Impaler. So he starts reading up on him and connects that to Transylvania. Now, Vlad the Impaler was from Wallachia, which was a province in the south of Transylvania. Excuse me, south of Romania. Transylvania is just on the border, just above it. So Bram took license and moved Vlad the Impaler one state up and placed him in a, you know, location where he needed him to be, which is an extinct volcano. Why is that? Volcanoes were portals to hell, the home of the devil.
So question, how does Slane's castle connect to this?
Ah, good question. So much like Bram merged Vlad the Impaler with his devil, and also he took a little bit of Henry Irving playing the role of Mephistopheles, the devil, in the play Faust. So Bram was pulling bits and pieces of realistic experiences, historical characters, and superstition to make what he wanted, and that was his Count Dracula. He did the same with Castle Dracula. He saw two pictures of Bran Castle near Brasov, which is the famous Castle Dracula, they call it to this day. And then he saw the picture in these two books where he wrote his description. Harper comes up the castle and describes it a certain way. There's no question it is the sketches in these books, one by Bonner, one by Machicelli, that is what he's describing. But the interior, since he never went to Romania or stepped foot near Bran Castle, he actually wrote Dracula in Cruden Bay, Scotland, and he went inside it. And I've been inside it now. There is a hallway leading from the front door exactly the way he describes Jonathan Harker in Chapter 2, pulling up to the castle, going through a hall, entering into another room, an octagonal room lit by a single lamp with no windows to the outside. Guess what, fellas? That's exactly how Slane's castle is laid out. So he merged these two castles to make them feel believable, places that he'd been, places that he'd seen, to make his fictional castle. He just had to move it 400 miles to the north on this volcano.
That Slane castle looks like in ruins now. Was it like that before?
No, it's a great question. Sadly, this sort of happened a lot in Scotland and in parts of England. Mostly in Scotland, though, where the ruling class, the earls, would own all the land, right? And they would allow the people, the farmers, to farm it. And they'd pay them a rent for it. After World War II, apparently, when international ship travel got much cheaper, and the world was trading grain a lot easier and quicker, the price of grains dropped in Scotland and parts of England, so that the value of this guy, the Earl of Errol's holdings, the bottom fell out. And so he couldn't afford to keep everybody on. He wasn't making any money. He was losing money. So what they do over there, which is really quite sad, is they might not sell the actual land, but they sell all the fixtures, the slate roof, the windows, the lead lining, the paneling, all the upholstery. And then once the roof is off of a ruin, you don't have to pay tax anymore because it's a ruin. So that's how the Earl of Errol, the family had owned it for 500 years. That's why they had to basically have a fire sale. And that's why it is what it is today.
Did they sell the light?
Oh, I can't believe you asked that, because I was doing a presentation in the Kilmarnock Arms Hotel, which is the same hotel Bram was in. It's been renovated a number of times. It's beautiful. I was doing a presentation with my buddy Mike Shepherd, who's a local guy in Cruden Bay. He's an author. He's done great research in the area. I'm really beholden to him. He's got pieces that are going into this film as well. So he and I were giving a talk. The whole town came. I mean, it was really incredible to have 250 people squeezed in this thing because they wanted to hear the Stoker relative talking. And I was kind of nervous because, you know, when you're in that area, it would be like if I go to Buffalo and I start telling people about how to make buffalo wings, you know, I better be on my game, right? And then someone's going to go, now, wait a second, where the hell are you from? So I'm talking about the octagonal room, and I'm reading this piece of Dracula, and lit by a single lamp, a man gets up in the back. I am Robert Hay. That's my family that used to own the castle. I own that lamp. Everybody turned and looked. I mean, he is still the aristocracy. He was really well-dressed. He had some of his members of his family with him. And Mike and I think our faces probably dropped like, oh, geez, did we say something wrong? He was thrilled to death, but he said, when my family was separating everything, I really wanted that lamp. I remembered it as a kid. And so he's got the lamp hanging in his house in Chelsea in London, and he sent us a photograph.
Wow.
That's going to be in the documentary. How cool is that? You get lucked into things like that, don't you, sometimes?
I got lucky and asked that question. So Bram saw that lamp, likely.
Yep, he would have. Yeah, we believe there is no guest book at the Slane's Castle. There is a guest book at Kilmarnock Arms Hotel that Bram signed. And Mike has said, listen, there's no question a celebrity like Bram Stoker, being the manager of Lyceum Theater for the famous Sir Henry Irving, there's no question he would not have been invited to Slane's Castle to meet the Earl and have drinks with him. As a matter of fact, I found an article a number of years later where Bram was invited on a shooting party, you know, pheasant shooting, with the Earl of Errol. So there's no question he went inside, even though he didn't have to write in his notes, you know, on my visit to Slane's Castle, I noticed this. I think I'll use this for Jonathan Harker walking in.
Right.
But it's really cool because, as Mike Shepherd found, a photograph of the front door of Slane's Castle, the way Bram described the front door with no knocker is exactly the same way as he described Harker going into Castle Dracula, no knocker, you know, boom, 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 after you hit your hand. So I think Bram was reenacting kind of his feel. He's maybe a little bit intimidated to walk up to the big castle and knock on the door because he's been invited in, and maybe there was chains rattling, who knows, but he would have seen that lamp. And I have seen photographs in the Edinburgh archives of what that room looked like, with incredible artwork, beautiful paneling and rugs and things. It was really quite something. It was, you know, in the heyday, that was the place to be.
Wow.
You know, one thing I noticed in the notes, that so now Bram toured the U.S. 8 times, and he came into contact with Buffalo Bill Cody. And there was a relationship there. Sounds like he really had a rich life here. and I'd imagine this is also the time he must have picked up about the vampire scare in New England in the 1800s. He must have learned about it probably while he visited. Maybe I'm wrong, but.
No, you absolutely. I mean, listen, you're more than right. There was a newspaper article in his notes about that New England vampire scare. And I believe, because it was dated, I think it was September of 1896, and he was still writing Dracula. It wasn't published until May of 97. There was two, and remember, This article is stuck in the back of his notebook, so it's there. The question is, did he take anything from it and use the novel? And I'll say, Alan, absolutely. There was a reference to Charles Darwin mentioning, when I was in South America, these large bats came out of the trees and drank blood out of the cattle. He discovered the vampire bat on this trip, and it's mentioned in the novel, in the newspaper article, because what the article's all about is the tuberculosis outbreak in New England being sort of misunderstood as a vampire scare, because people who moved to New England from the old country kept these superstitions with them. But the parallel the writer was doing was saying, ooh, maybe there's a connection to these vampire bats. So what Bram did was almost word for word, when Quincy Morris, the American, was in attendance with the other band of heroes, and Van Helsing is trying to explain to Dr. Seward, the scientist, listen, you gotta believe what's going on. You may not be able to explain why this Lucy is losing all this blood overnight. We've given her a transfusion before she went to sleep. We come in the next day, she's pale, there's no blood lying on the ground. What the heck is going on? And Quincy Morris said, oh, when I was in South America, these big bats would come out of the trees at night, and one drank so much blood from my favorite horse, my favorite mare, I had to put her down. So that's what he got out of that. I think the other thing he got out of the article is, I think, I'm lucky. I'm going to sell a lot of books in America if in 1890 they're still believing this stuff.
Well, yeah, and what about his relationship with Bill Cody then? How it seemed to last a long time. You said that he helped bring him to the UK in the Wild West show.
Yeah, I mean, you know, first of all, Henry Irving came with Bram. Bram was the lead man, came over a number of times, set up everything, all the logistics, all the train travel. I've actually found, and this will be in the documentary, a map that Bram drew on to show all the train routes and how long between each city, because he was responsible to not only get Henry Irving and Ellen Terry into a nice car and off to the hotel, but they traveled with 100 people from the Lyceum Theater, set designers, painters, costume guys, everything. So it's a massive logistical nightmare. So Irving was really popular, and he was a showman himself. And when they met out west, I think in Wyoming somewhere, they met Buffalo Bill Cody, there was immediate sort of connection, because they recognized an equally incredible showman. And he had an incredible show. And they said, look, we're going to help you come to the UK. So on this same trip, when he got the newspaper article from the New York World, they were out on, I think, Coney Island and saw the Wild West show again. And they said, look, we're going to help you make arrangements. We've got people over here in Edinburgh, Glasgow, in London, and they just made all the right connections and helped get them over and promote them. But it goes a step further, Alan. Again, it's the tendency of my great-granduncle to take things that are real, Vlad the Impaler, Castle Dracula, Slane's Castle, these ideas of superstition and things floating around different countries where people really believe the spirits of the dead come out. He took the attributes of Buffalo Bill Cody, who he admired. A brash American, Quincy Morris. That's where he got sort of the persona of this guy with a gun and the cowboy hat, but also his slang, use of slang language amongst the very well-to-do British Lady Lucy. And he also used Buffalo Bill as a basis for two other characters in his novels. One is a guy called Elias Hutcheson in... A short story that Bram wrote called The Squaw. I turned it in with Christopher McCauley, who you and I have chatted before about, into a graphic novel called The Virgin's Embrace. And Elias Hutcheson is a brash American from the west part of the country, very much like Buffalo Bill, who goes to Nuremberg to see the scary sights, the Nuremberg Castle with all of its torture devices, and bad stuff happens. So that's character number two that's Buffalo Bill Cody morphed into what Bram needed. And number three, I don't think Bram quite understood the significance when he wrote Shoulder of Shasta and had an American sort of mountain man named Grizzly Dick as the sort of the protagonist to meet up with this British lady who needed to leave musty England because of her allergies and asthma and come to the American West that's much drier. And so she met up with the unfortunately named Grizzly Dick, who was another sort of morphed character of Buffalo Bill Cody. So that's that's his connection. And besides getting him and all of his crew, the Indians and the horses, onto ships, I've seen a picture of them all over, and were major big hits in the UK for a number of years.
Right. That happens to be Michael's name as well, Grizzly Dick.
Big name?
Yeah.
You know, but
that's a different story.
On a good day. On a good day.
That's right.
Now, you're going to cover a lot of his life, too, right? Because he was one of seven children, you know, and his family sounded very, you know, how do I say it? You know, female right activist, doctor, civil servant. Like, you've got all these different characters. And also, he was religious, too, but yet covered the occult. And you're going to talk about his sexuality and his marriage and all that stuff. There's a lot of things going on in his personal life as well, isn't there?
There is, and that's, you know, you sort of, I don't want this to be some just sort of boring, this is the way he was type thing. Right. It's like, we want people to subtly see the kind of man that emerged from this very interesting family, you know, three doctors, my great-grandfather being one of them, three scientists, civil servants, you know, not the most creatives, and here's Bram, the one creative that has the guts to start writing. Even when his father is kind of pushing him to become a clerk in the Petty Sessions legal department. He also helped start the Dublin Painting and Sketching Club. So what Jason and John and I have figured out is we need to create these subtle moments where the viewer can better understand Bram through his thoughts and words and actions rather than just me being the narrator saying, well, he was a complex young man and he was troubled because of this. Or people have misinterpreted, in my opinion, the letter he wrote to Walt Whitman that was bearing his soul about Whitman's writing, his sort of avant-garde writing and his freedom of writing. And it's proof that Bram Stoker was, you know, bisexual or something, you know, that just, I don't want to jump into all that and refute things that have been said with no basis. I want to present Bram as a very interesting, deep thinking person and where these ideas came from. And really let people, you know, draw conclusions. But between John and I doing the script and me doing the narration, we'll put obviously facts out there. But the whole idea is it's done in a way that a subtle way that the viewer of the documentary will I think come to a conclusion as I've done that Bram was a very interesting and complex guy, and you know it's kind of sad he dies in 1912, that he hasn't seen success of his book on stage or anything else. I mean, he knew it was successful as a novel, but he didn't really know what happened to it after that.
Right. How did the community, how did the area, and even the UK, how did people receive a book like Dracula at that time? How was it thought of?
Well, let me throw this name at the two of you guys. We'll play a little word association for a moment, because I find it interesting, and I bet you Michael has dealt with this doing work in Victorian era. If I said the word to you guys, sensational, what does that mean back in 1897 versus what it might mean today? Any ideas that worth a little chat?
The sensational as in what the newspapers were trying to do with the sensationalism, is something to that effect?
Yeah, in other words, the reviewers said in many cases, this novel was of a sensational matter, far too sensational for our, you know, our sensitivities at the moment. That's the context. So it was sensational and to some extent far too over the top for people to get.
Right. Yeah, that's how I would have figured. Because what were people living like then, and what were they thinking? And if there were fears where people were actually scared of vampires and stuff, there must have been did they have a weird impression of who Bram was then?
Well, he kind of had two sides to him. And that's what freaked people out. He was the very upstanding theatrical manager, you know, all the books were just right, the money, the organization, everything. He was very straight and narrow when it came to running the theater. But this mystical, Irish mystical writer side of him exposed a whole other side, Alan. This sort of, and somebody wrote, actually it was New York Times. I won't get it right, but I love to read it every now and then when I'm on a stage to people. It's his obituary. And it was, there was a touch of Celtic mysticism in Bram Stoker. And he wrote about it with passion, almost like it was inviting us to understand or try to understand what was going on in his mind. And that's the side that he shows, but not that much in his writing. That's the side Figgis and Stoker and West are going to try to show in this documentary.
Question, Digger. Being Irish, I was automatically assuming that he was Irish Catholic. But was he? What were... No.
Great question, Michael, because that's another piece of, you know, you're in the minority as an Irish Protestant. He went to Trinity College, which was mostly Catholic. He was a religious man, obviously marrying a church in those days. You obviously that was right. But when you really think about Dracula and the fact that the church was losing its kind of stranglehold of absolute power, he still recognized the religious overtones, using the crucifix, the wafer, the holy water. But he was also pushing the fact that amongst all the other beliefs that man may have in religion and superstition, he must have faith in goodness and in fellow man to overcome the dark side. And that's what I get from analyzing his spirituality, his religion.
Now, at the end of Dracula, how it ended in the movies and the shows and even the final book, was the original manuscript different, had a different ending? Is that true?
Absolutely. That was something that I gleaned from a few hours in Seattle, Washington, with the Paul Allen had purchased. He's the Microsoft co-founder Dracula manuscript. And since it's typed, some of us call it a typescript, I found that the first 102 pages were cut out, actually 101, because it started on page 102, but also the ending was cut out. And that this is another thing that we talk about, because it brings everything full circle. I talked about 20 minutes ago about the devil, about why Bram's notes that live in Philadelphia mention certain very specific coordinates that lead Jonathan Harker and us, the researchers, to an extinct volcano in the Kalamani National Park called Mount Israel. Well, that was an extinct volcano. The original ending of Dracula that was crossed out, I believe, by Bram's publisher, because he didn't want a definitive ending, included right after the band of heroes fight off the gypsies, rip open the crate, and slit the Count's neck, and then the American, Quincy, stabs the Count with his bowie knife, not a stake, and the Count crumbles into dust. Right after that happens, which is now cut out of the typescript and it doesn't appear in any novels, the massive volcano erupted. And when it erupted, Castle Dracula comes down and crumbles down. The good guys get away somehow, and the gypsies all take off. And, of course, we don't know exactly what happens to the Count because he's crumbled into dust. Had that that volcano actually erupted, it probably would have given the impression to the reader that Count Dracula is actually destroyed. But a less ambiguous ending is now an apparent because it's, you know, no volcanic eruption and the Count maybe escaped by crumbling into dust, leaving the door open for Dracula to live on 127 years later. And he keeps popping up in films and streaming, and even his great grandnephew writes a prequel and a sequel about it all.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing, actually, you know. And also, I was reading this discovery of the Icelandic and Swedish translation of Dracula, and it reveals a different preface. So what do you mean by that? Like, what's that all about?
So if you open up, and any of your listeners open up a copy of Dracula, you'll see that the preface is about a paragraph long. And it, too, is a little bit ambiguous, but it leads you to believe that Bram is saying there's a realistic element to this story. But the preface that's been discovered and has been sitting in Iceland in a published book since 1901, and it was up until 2015 that Hans de Roos, a buddy of mine who's a fellow researcher, we traveled together, dug into stuff together, he translated not just the preface, because a guy called Richard Dalby did that in 1989 and found that the preface was very convincing that the story was real. And as Michael will enjoy, it actually mentioned in the story the Jack the Ripper murders.
Oh.
Yes, sir. But we'll come into the story a little later. So for some reason, that is different. But as de Roos and others, and myself included, have analyzed the Swedish book and the Icelandic book, they were all published in newspapers before they were published as a novel. And now what we believe is the newspaper editor customized or edited the story to make it a little more, let's say, gruesome, a little more sexual, and a little bit more appropriate to scare the heck out of people in their country, because it included a lot of political fascism. It included Count Dracula looking a little bit more like a political leader coming to London to wreak havoc rather than drinking blood from fair maidens. And he doesn't die at the end of the story like the Count Dracula Bram story. So, Alan, it throws, you know, this puzzle that I'm talking about. It is, you know, a Swedish piece and an Icelandic piece, but it's a piece that has not been confirmed. It just adds to the Dracula soup that's like, this is a mystery. We may not ever answer it.
Pretty fascinating. You know, the whole story, his whole life. It's just amazing. So what is it you're hoping that people can do to help out with the documentary?
Well, if you enjoyed listening to our chat, and I certainly have, you know, if you'd like to see this become a reality, April 1st, Indiegogo, the art campaign, The Father of Dracula, goes live, and get in there and contribute. These things, as you know, in crowdfunding, you end up with little rewards here and there. But mostly, you know, in our case, it's like, yeah, we give out books and signs of stuff, but we just need the money to get Jason Figgis into a high-end a studio to edit all of the work that's already been done. I mean, everything else out of our own pocket, we just need some help to get it edited, and then hopefully it will show up at film festivals. It might get on the streaming networks. Who knows? Where, you know, it's just the success of the work that we've all done. If it gets picked up, then it'll appeal to a broader audience rather than just having to stick it on YouTube. But there's nothing wrong with that. But we'd like to get it to, you know, into other places before we go that route.
Right. And Jason is award winning. He's quality.
Yeah, no, yeah. Like, I just got to say before we end this, the Sir Simon Marsden film that he did with,
yes,
I mean, absolutely incredible. That's what hooked me to Jason Figgis years ago, was the sensitivity about this a famous photographer who was knighted for his ability to kind of show the gothic sensitivities of the potential of ghosts. Very, yeah, very interesting. And that's give me the vibe that I felt that he could do also with my great grand uncle. And that's why I hooked up to his team.
Well, fantastic. So let's talk about, do you have contact information, or do you have, where should people go also to find out more?
Well, you can go to dacrestoker.com. I don't have a page yet on that for Father Dracula. You can also follow me on Facebook, Dacre Stoker Author. And then the Bram Stoker Estate.com is a website my wife and I run. We put lots of information about the family there. And if you ever want to read any of Bram's books for free, here is your free advice today. BramStoker.org, as opposed to BramStokerEstate.com.org, has all of his free stuff. So there's some free info, places to follow me. And if you follow me or Jason Figgis or John West on Facebook or Instagram, that we'll be updating people about exactly how the campaign's going. But you go to Indiegogo, April 1st, Father of Dracula, all the info will be there for you.
Well, fantastic. Well, appreciate you being here and coming on and talking about all this, and wish you the best.
Yeah, well, that was great.
It's the right place to be, the House of Mystery, guys, and I thank you for your time, your interest, and Alan said we haven't chatted for a while, but thank you for connecting. And Michael, it's about damn time we did connect. So good
that
luck
is
with
right.
your project too, buddy.
Thank you, and it's awesome talking with you. Take
All
you.
Right, guys. Take care now.
This has been a production of the House of Mystery Radio Show. To find out more about our show, guests, or hosts, go to our website at houseofmysteryradio.com. You've been listening to the House of Mystery Radio Show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.